Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your minerals and royalties. And Justin Williams, my individual mineral owner co-host, is here with me. Hey, Justin.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me, as always.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on the show. In today's episode, we're going to cover mineral rights news for July 2020. I hope everybody is having a safe and happy start to their summer. And some interesting articles this month, Justin, about more bankruptcies in the oil patch, which is not a big surprise like we've talked about in the past. And then some surprising turn of events, I'll say, in terms of the Oxy mineral rights sale in Wyoming and Colorado. So do you want to just go ahead and dive into that first article?
Let's do it. So we're going to dive in here. So Colorado State Manager of Land and Mineral Rights won't be bidding to buy Northern Colorado property being sold by the oil company Occidental Petroleum in a giant sell of millions of acres. The lion's share of the property, originally part of the 1862 federal land grant to the Union Pacific Railroad, is in Wyoming, where Occidental is the state's largest private landowner. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon's office said last month that it had enlisted investment bank Barclays to help the state government assess acquiring 4 million mineral rights acres and 1 million acres of surface land from Occidental, saying Wyoming held special appeal as a buyer. About 600,000 acres of mineral rights in the Colorado core of the Denver-Julesburg Basin are part of the land grant Occidental owns. That's not believed to be included in what's for sale. We focused on growing assets that produce recurring revenue, such as accretive agriculture, water rights, recreation, and renewable energy, as opposed to extractive, non-recurring revenue assets, said Kristen Kemp of the Colorado State Land Board. CEO Vicki Holub touched on it last month during a call with Investment Analysis, in which she said the land grant drew 13 bidders in a first round of the company's auction. So this is really interesting, Matt. I think we kind of assumed that Colorado was going to be bidding on those, and to see that they're not, that's a turn.
Yeah, I would have assumed that they would have seen the value in that from a recurring revenue standpoint. Somebody needs to give Kristen Kemp an education on severance taxes as a recurring revenue asset. So clearly it's a political statement that they're making, that they're focusing on things like recreation, water rights, and renewables, as opposed to extractive industries being mining and oil and gas. And so it being not popular from a political standpoint to be anywhere near oil and gas, especially with the changes that have been made at the state level, as many of you know, with passage of SB 181 last year and the change in the way they're regulating oil and gas. So I guess from that standpoint, it's not terribly surprising. I'd say it's disappointing, though, because the state is facing a shortfall in funding education. And the article mentions that the Colorado State Land Board manages a $4.1 billion endowment and associated land and mineral rights assets that do fund the schools. And so to me, if you have that issue, making that investment in schools, because they, Kristen Kemp did acknowledge in this article that oil and gas leases generated $121.9 million for the State Land Board school funding last year. And I don't know if that's referring to just the lease bonuses or if that's actually the severance tax revenue. But I could see if her standpoint is from a lease bonus point of view. I do agree that there won't be a ton of leasing in the near term with the prices being low. So the state, they were relying on lease bonus revenue that would not be recurring revenue, but certainly as oil and gas is produced and the severance tax revenue is recurring. So I think a bit short-sighted, to be honest, from the state's standpoint. I think they're looking at, unfortunately, letting politics drive short-term decisions rather than looking at the long-term value, because hopefully we'll see the oil and gas industry continue to exist in Colorado once oil prices recover and additional drilling occurs in the DJ Basin. Then I think they're passing up an opportunity to generate that revenue to help fund education in the future. And, you know, because the fact of the matter is we're really nowhere near dominated by renewable energy at this point. And so in this energy transition that we're starting, that's going to take decades, oil and gas production still can be a valuable asset to the state in generating revenue. So unfortunate, you know, kind of a bit of a surprise, I guess, that they're passing up on the opportunity, because it, you know, opportunities like this don't come along very often for land and mineral positions that are this large. The thing that the article did say, and this maybe this is part of why they're passing on it, but like you mentioned, Justin, that 600,000 acres of the minerals that Oxy owns are in the Colorado core of the DJ Basin, and that's not believed to be what's in, for sale. I believe it's some of the fringe acreage. And so from that standpoint, that acreage may not be developed for many years. And at that point, maybe it is something where they can pass on the opportunity just because they're not going to get the money back in the short term. So from an investment standpoint, you know, without having seen their analysis, it's hard to say what is totally driving the decision. But from reading the article, it does sound like it is political, which is unfortunate. All right, so the next article, we talk about ExxonMobil. So ExxonMobil resists write-downs as oil gas prices plummet. And the subtitle is, some accountants have filed an SEC complaint saying the company should write down the value of shale driller XTO Energy. Exxon says it is in compliance with standards. And so as many of you know, ExxonMobil is the owner of XTO Energy, which is their subsidiary, which is the shale producing arm of the company. And obviously with the drop in oil and gas prices, the value of their holdings drops as well. So it's based on, you know, how much they're going to generate in revenue from oil and gas produced. With the prices having plummeted, that revenue projection is going to plummet. And then the other thing too that it does, and the reason for the write-downs that we're starting to see from companies like BP and then most recently Shell, is because these assets are not economic at current prices, they are being proactive in writing down the value on their balance sheet of those reserves because they are not projecting them to be economic or to be drilled. And there's SEC requirements regarding the way that reserves are booked. And in order for them to book it, they've got to have the plan to develop the position within the next 5 years. And so what it's indicating to the market is that they don't have plans to develop that acreage in the next 5 years. And so that's why they're writing down those assets. And that's not all of their reserves, is just the portion of the reserves that are now no longer economic. They've got to write those down per SEC standards. And so the article mentions that rivals, including BP PLC, Hess Corp, and Occidental Petroleum, have recently taken multi-billion dollar impairments as a coronavirus-induced economic slowdown adds pressure to an already struggling shale sector. Chevron Corp took a $10 billion write-down in December. And remember, that was before prices tanked. And then Royal Dutch Shell was in the news recently last Tuesday, saying that it would write down the value of its assets by up to $22 billion because of lower energy prices. And from looking at the Royal Dutch Shell press release, it was related to, I think, their integrated gas and then also their shale business in the U.S. And so the article talks about the fact that Exxon has only taken $6.5 billion in write-downs since 2014, which is less than a quarter of some of its competitors. It also mentions that the fact that complainants or the group of attorneys and accountants that filed the complaint with the SEC, and they said that Exxon should be writing down the value of XTO by at least $17 billion and impairing at least $20 billion in other assets, depending on how it has booked the details. And so it would put it on par with like a Shell type write-down. And instead, they're not taking a write-down. And the claim that the article mentioned that Exxon is standing by is that they believe that prices are going to rebound and that would alleviate the need to write down the reserves that are currently uneconomic. And clearly that did not sit well with those, I don't know, there were activist investors, but activist accountants. And so it's interesting that they are resisting that in the current price environment. They clearly must be bullish internally on their price decks and what the commodity prices are going to be to be able to support not writing down the value of their assets. And so the other thing that is really interesting about this, I think, when you dig into it from a philosophical and strategic point of view, I think it highlights the fundamental difference in the mindset between ExxonMobil and the other major oil and gas companies related to transitioning to renewable energy. Exxon has always been resisting that and resisting any move towards admitting to climate change. And so a lot of other oil companies have sort of said, we're not going to win this argument. Let's just say that climate change exists. Let's take that as fact, whether or not it is a whole nother argument that you could have a complete episode on. If that's the boundary conditions that we have to live by in the current business environment, how do we strategically pivot to live in that new energy future? And so, and that was kind of evidenced by the fact that BP and Shell both have announced plans to be net carbon zero by, I think, 2050. And so, and to prepare for that, I think what they're doing is they're extending the message by taking the massive write-downs that they are taking right now in terms of BP and Shell and Hess and Chevron, for example. I think they're sending a strong message that they believe that they need to make that strategic shift away from earnings being dominated by oil and gas production and chemicals. In fact, I saw an article yesterday that BP is divesting their petrochemicals business. So they're clearly moving in that direction away from fossil fuels and to more of a energy company with the mix being both fossil fuels and then renewables. And both of, I think that's smart from the standpoint that the market is clearly has no appetite for fossil fuels anymore, right or wrong. You know, you have activist investors saying that they need to do more to acknowledge climate change and to prevent it, and environmentalists getting involved and suing the companies and so forth. So I think they may be signaling that they believe some of their reserves are effectively stranded assets at this point. So whether it's for political reasons or economic reasons, that they may never produce that oil and gas that's in the ground. And so I think that, you know, obviously, unless prices materially change, ultimately look at the return on investment and do what's going to return the most to shareholders. But assuming that they are pretty pessimistic on oil prices, which is kind of the headlines that I'm reading from a lot of the majors, is if that is the case, they're saying, we believe that this is possibly an asset that we may not be able to produce economically. And so we need to write it down. Let's move forward and look at the next opportunity. And so I think we're seeing a shift in the business models at companies like BP and Shell, whereas ExxonMobil is clearly resisting this change, you know, according to reading this article and what's happening here. It'll be interesting to see if the low oil and gas prices persist. You know, they're going to have a hard time sticking to their guns, I think. They're going to end up having to take a write down. Otherwise, it'd be pretty blatant in terms of not following SEC guidelines, I think. And the interesting thing about this particular claim that these accountants and attorneys are making is that it's a whistleblower claim. And so they've referred it to the Department of Justice. And if they actually assess a penalty to Exxon, they can get up to between a 10 and 30%, you know, payment from the government from that penalty. So if they're able to get, if the DOJ is able to stick a penalty on Exxon, this group is going to get 10 to 30% of that. So they could potentially have a lot to gain. So there could be some financial motivation to this particular claim. But I thought that was a pretty interesting article. What did you think, Justin?
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting. And it'll be interesting to follow it and see how this ends up shaking out. I think that was a very insightful view into maybe what's actually going on from the standpoint of the way that upper management is thinking at the oil companies. So I hope that Exxon is right, but we will see.
We will see for sure. And do you want to go ahead and read the last article now?
Let's do it. So fracking pioneer Chesapeake Energy Corporation on Sunday became the largest oil and gas company to file for bankruptcy protection during the coronavirus pandemic. But more recently, bankruptcy rumors have swirled around Chesapeake as the company grappled with depressed energy prices and a poorly timed push into oil and a mountain of debt. Earlier this month, Chesapeake skipped interest payments of $13.5 million, according to filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The company had a 30-day grace period before it would be considered in default. About 30% of the U.S. shale operations are technically insolvent at $35 a barrel oil prices. According to the recent Deloitte study, the report estimated that the shale industry will be forced to write down the value of its assets by as much as $300 billion. So that's huge, Matt. And I think, you know, we had talked in a previous show that this was probably coming, so not a huge surprise.
So, yeah, not a huge surprise. And it looks like our prediction in our operator bankruptcy episode came true. And Chesapeake had to file bankruptcy. So if you remember back to that episode, we talked about our projections for some companies that are likely to file bankruptcy in the near future. And Chesapeake was featured on that list, which wasn't a huge guess on our part. It was pretty clear. I think at that point, they'd already skipped that interest payment. So it was just a matter of time. But they were already struggling, like I said, and it came to fruition, and unfortunately, they had to file bankruptcy. And so this article mentions some of the plans they have around the refinancing of debt and how they're going to restructure. So, you know, tough situation they were in. They were highly leveraged. Their balance sheet was a mess. And so now they're paying the price for that. And they mentioned this Deloitte study, which I think is really interesting. They say that 30% are insolvent at $35 a barrel. To me, that's not a huge surprise. In fact, I would say that at $35 a barrel, the probably more than 30% of operators are actually insolvent. I think it just depends on how they're reporting. And there's been some articles I've read recently that talk about how companies have overstated the return on investment from some of the shale wells. And so if that is indeed the case, then I think you're looking at numbers that are a lot higher than 30% of the industry that are insolvent at current prices. And it's unfortunate, but I think one of the things that it does highlight is we had this downturn in 2015, and there was some focus on companies getting more efficient and leaner. And they did that to a certain extent, but I think then they got sort of complacent with the cheap debt, and they were able to spend their way out of that downturn without really having to generate a profit. And going forward, that's not going to be the case, obviously. They're going to have to be efficient in their operations across every part of the business in order to make money in a lower price environment, which I think we're likely to see for a while. And it just really highlights the need to focus on continuous improvement and to ingrain that in the mindset and the culture of these companies. In the past, it's really just been the large operators that have put a focus on kind of centralizing the management of the way they do things. So the process management and the data and using data quality and analytics to really look at opportunities to improve the way they do business. And I think what it's highlighting now is that really, no matter the size of the company, it's really not just a big operator need to focus on continuous improvement. It's got to be part and parcel of every company. And I think in the analogy to this, if you look at car makers, for example, you have Toyota with the Toyota Production System. They have just a track record of being a pioneer around continuous improvement, building quality into the product at every step of the way. And the reason they do that, surprisingly, it's not quality for quality's sake. It's actually to improve their profitability. And so they can be more profitable because they have fewer steps and less time that goes into the making of a Toyota vehicle, perhaps than a GM or other car makers. And, you know, you think about those are the major car companies, GM, Ford, Toyota. They've started to look at this from a long time ago when they saw Toyota have this success. They were starting to adopt these continuous improvement processes and systems. And then you have Tesla that comes along, and they see the need to do this from the beginning. And actually what they did is they hired a lot of the Toyota folks in their manufacturing operations just straight from Toyota, because they knew that they had to come out of the gate with this continuous improvement mindset and to be as lean as possible and in order to be profitable and to succeed in manufacturing vehicles. And so that is an area that shale operators haven't done. So you've had the kind of the equivalents of the GMs and the Fords with the Shell, the BP, the Chevrons, the bigger companies that have a lot of overhead. They look at how do they can streamline things. They have central groups that manage their business process and data and so forth. And the smaller shale operators saying, oh, we don't need to do that. We're nimble. We're not going to need to focus on those same process improvement things. And so they just go off and they start to repeat some of the mistakes that the larger integrated oil and gas companies have learned over the years. And they're paying the price for it now. So even the smaller operators are having a tough time of it right now with these low oil prices. When you think that smaller operators be leaner, lower overhead, they wouldn't have this same issue, but it's not the case. So,
yeah, and I think you said it absolutely wonderfully, Matt. And I think for any business, it's the case that the mindset has just changed a little bit. What we do in the future has to be different than what we've done in the past. Nobody saw this coming. And to think about having to prepare for the future, I think that's on the top of any business's mind. And it's always been a boom or bust in oil and gas. But I think a lot of these companies have put a lot of focus into trying to change that. But maybe at times the moving quick just got ahead of the focus on that.
Yeah, I think there was this cheap capital that sort of spoiled the party. You know, I think there was that focus on trying to be more efficient in the last downturn. They sort of got away from that because they were able to, because, you know, there was a lot of money coming in. Cost of capital was very low. So they could borrow money and not have to pay the piper right away until when the prices fell and they're now insolvent. So yeah, I think it's going to be, it's going to require a paradigm shift in the industry to where they need that culture of continuous improvement, of lean and nimble, even if prices bounce back and go up again. And it'd be a shame if we got complacent again let higher oil prices allow waste to creep back into the system. I think that the industry really needs to stay vigilant about lowering their costs and becoming more efficient in order to survive in the volatile commodity price environment that we're likely to see in the future. So, all right. Well, with that wraps up our July news episode. And as always, you can find links to these articles that we talked about today at mineralrightspodcast.com. And just go to the July 2020 news episode page and you'll find them there. And as always, we appreciate rating and review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to this. We have a couple of reviews that we have on the backlog. We got to give a shout out to those listeners here in a future episode. But if you'd like a shout out as well, please leave us a rating and review. And we will talk to you next time. Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.